Good morning. Rosh Hashanah is close on our heels. It's worth looking into a little bit the proper mood and the attitude that's relevant to this time of year. I remember once a few years ago, without mentioning any names, not getting into any politics, but there was a politician who was running in the New York City area and was appealing to the Jewish vote. And a comedian commented that this week is Rosh Hashanah, it's the Jewish New Year, so this comedian is going to be, this politician is going to be in Times Square with a horn and a ribbon and a drink, singing and cheering. And the audience laughed at that because the audience realized, even the non-Jewish audience realized, that there is clearly a big difference in mood and atmosphere between the Jewish New Year and January 1st. And it's not just a question of the date, it's not just a question that whatever happens on January 1st is moved over to Rosh Hashanah time. But it's clear and it's obvious that there is a wholly different atmosphere on Rosh Hashanah than there is on January 1st. In fact, just the phrase itself, Happy New Year, worth examining to what extent, if any, is that relevant to Rosh Hashanah. That we know that happiness actually is a mitzvah, it is an obligation in relation to Yontif in general. And we're told, v'samachta b'chagecha, we have an obligation of simcha in relation to Sukkot, the Pesach, and the Shavuos. So what about Rosh Hashanah? How does Rosh Hashanah fit within that spectrum? Is there an obligation of simcha on Rosh Hashanah? So that's actually not so clear. It's not so clear from the Chumash. It's not so clear from the Gemara. And it's something that Rishonim dealt with behind the scenes, and Achronim dealt with more explicitly. Perhaps most prominently in the late 1600s, the Shagas Aryeh, in a few essays, talks about this topic at length. And more recently, in the past century, the Arsameach, and his sefer, Brother Rambam, also gave serious attention to this question. The chiyuv of simcha, the obligation of happiness, that appeals, that applies to all the other Yom Tovim, so is that relevant to Rosh Hashanah and to Yom Kippur as well? They're probably in the same category, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. So is there an obligation of simcha in relation to these days? And there are reasons on both sides. There are reasons to say that the obligation of simcha would seem to apply. On the one hand, it's a yontif. Seems to be, we act like a yontif. All of our behavior during the day seems consistent with every other yontif that we have. And thematically also, seems like a happy time. We know the Gemara tells us in a few places that Yom Kippur was one of the two happiest days of the year, together with Tu B'Av, and the Gemara considers Yom Kippur to be the obvious one. That one we know for sure is the happiest day of the year. Tu B'Av, we have to be told some reasons why it is. Yom Kippur, a day of Slicha and Kafara, clearly that should be the happiest day of the year. So from a halachic perspective and from a thematic perspective, there is a case to be made that there should be simcha on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. On the other hand, so there are reasons to say not that way. There are reasons to think maybe there isn't simcha. It's not exactly the same as the other regalim. We don't have an aliyah l'regel. We don't have shalmei simcha. There are aspects of the day that are missing on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, which are key to the simcha obligation. And from the thematic point of view, we have issues also. Thematically, the jury is out on us. We're waiting for a verdict. Clearly is anxiety that comes with the day. So to say that it's a day when we can really celebrate without worrying, to say it's a day comparable to Shavuos, is difficult to say. So both from the halachic and from the thematic perspective, we see reasons to go in both directions. We see reasons to think that Simcha should apply no less than on the other Yom Tov. And we see reasons to not be so sure. We see reasons to think maybe there is a different character these days. So since we don't have a clear direction from the Chumash, we don't have a clear direction from the Gemara, and trying to figure it out on our own, we're not so sure which way to go. So I got to try to look for some clues somewhere. We'll try to look for some clues in the halacha. So I know I view the whole world through the prism of food. So the first place to look at would be food. Right? How does food relate to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur? And it's a serious question. Because we know that plays a big role in the aspect of Simcha of Yom Tovim. Yom Tovim, there is an obligation to eat, there is an obligation of Suda, and there's a prohibition to fast. So So if I wanted to have a personal fast day, if I decide I want to do tshuva, and I want to have a personal fast day in the Chol Moed Pesach, it's inappropriate. It's a violation of the simcha that is relevant to that time of year. It's not permitted. So what if I would want to have a fast on Rosh Hashanah? Am I permitted to fast on Rosh Hashanah? That's a question that's dealt with by Rishonim. The Torah quotes different opinions, discussion of the Rosh. And normally, when you have a question like that, you have any kind of question really, so the safe path, somebody asks you what the story is, the safe path is almost always machlokas. You say machlokas, you can rarely be wrong. But here, you have to know a little more, because to say it's machlokas, yes and no, it only gets you part of the way. Because there are at least six opinions on this question. At least six different views. So you'll start off with saying, say it's machlokas, you'll be right, but then you're going to have a little trouble finishing the sentence. So there are six possibilities at least. Maybe there are more. But this question, can one fast on Rosh Hashanah? So you find a couple of different views. First view you might find is no, you're not allowed to fast on Rosh Hashanah. It's a yotif. You can't fast on Sukkot. You can't fast on Shavuos. You can't fast on Rosh Hashanah either. This is actually relevant. It's interesting. This is relevant to the Ashkenazi practice, the prevalent Ashkenazi practice, the prevalent practice within an Ashkenazi Jewry, to begin Slichos 4 days before Rosh Hashanah. So where exactly that comes from is a discussion. Svardim begins Slichos Rosh Chodesh Elul. The Ran in Rosh Hashanah quotes three positions as to when Slichos should start, and this practice of at least 4 days before Rosh Hashanah is not really any of them. And the Ran discusses either it should be Rosh Chodesh Elul, or it should be Chaf Hei Elul, or it should be Rosh Hashanah, the Seder Shemei Tshuva should be the period of Slichos. The idea that it should start 4 days before Rosh Hashanah at least, and we then move it to the Motzei Shabbos, that it's at least 4 days before. It's a little bit of a question where that idea comes from. They find different theories, and one of the theories is that there was a practice, and clearly we're not on this level, that maybe you know people who are on this level, I don't know so many people who do this, but there is a practice to fast all of the Aseres Yemei Tshuva. All of the Aseres Yemei Tshuva should be fast days. And the problem is, four of them, one's not able to fast. Erev Yom Kippur, Shabbos, and the 2 days Rosh Hashanah. This is working with this position that one may not fast in Rosh Hashanah. So then, ideally, they're looking for 10 days of fasting, and you don't have, four of them are blocked off. So therefore, we push it up earlier, and we take from 4 days before Rosh Hashanah. I recently saw quoted in the name of the Rav, it's an interesting idea, that if the notion is to fast in between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, so okay, so then what's the point of taking other days? So either you're going to fast during that time or you're not going to be able to do it, but it doesn't seem to help to fast other days. So you see from here, you can develop this concept on your own, you see from here that there's an inyan of Aseres Yemei Tshuva, that it's not just that that's the time period between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, but that Tshuva has this shear, so to speak, of 10 days, and if you can't get them all in during that slot, so you pull some from before. It's an interesting notion. But this is all working off the assumption that Rosh Hashanah is not a time of fasting. And that's how some Rishonim say that Aseres Yemei Tshuva Ikri, Yemei Tainis Lo Ikri. It's not necessarily days of fasting. Tshuva doesn't have to always mean fasting. So that is a view you find, that one does not fast on Rosh Hashanah. So answer one of our six shitas, can you fast? No. Answer two, other Rishonim disagree, and say, can you fast? Yes, you can, and you should, it's a good idea. It is a way, again, this notion of making the Aseres Yemei Tshuva into a time of fasting is perhaps a good one in the view of some, and that would include Rosh Hashanah. And so yes, you may fast, and you should fast, would be the second view. The third view, somewhere in between, it's one that I think probably intrigues me the most, and will probably spend the most time on, is you can fast. It's permissible, not necessarily advocated, kind of in between. Yes, you may fast. Then we're left with three more positions. There are those who say you can fast on the second day, but not on the first day. So what's the distinction between the first day and the second day? Well, the first day is Daraisa, that's one issue. Some later Achronim point out also the first day is Rosh Hashanah, is Rosh Chodesh, and the second day is not Rosh Chodesh. It's a question whether or not Rosh Chodesh really has any influence on Rosh Hashanah. We have this idea, Tikku b'chodesh shofar, b'kesel yom chageinu, in the Chazal Darshan, izzehu chag sh'achodesh miskasaba. What's a yontif that hides Rosh Chodesh? So Rosh Hashanah is a yontif that where Rosh Chodesh is completely obscured. So whether or not there is any effect to the fact that Rosh Chodesh is taking place on Rosh Hashanah, It's unclear, but some suggest that that's behind this sheet. The first day you should fast, the second day is not to Rosh Chodesh and to Rabbanan. Maybe it's a different story. And then,
The second day considered, but then for Rosh Hashanah only the second day considered.
The Yom HaRichta, that's also a factor. So that's an argument in the other direction as well.
All right, Bolton, why wouldn't this be considered Bal Tosef? I mean, there's no mitzvah to fast, and you want to fast. So you're adding something on to this yontif.
So that's the question in general with the boundaries of Bal Tosef. So within Rosh Hashanah, it's an interesting question what the boundaries of Bal Tosef are. But to say that an optional practice that we take upon ourselves, if one chooses to do that, is in the category of Bal Tosef is difficult to say. Bal Tosef itself is a fascinating topic. Maybe we'll have to come back someday and talk about it. But here you have a biblical prohibition in which the boundaries are very unclear. Maybe it means to add on something within a mitzvah, to take a fifth min in your lulav, or to make a new, the Rambam understands Bal Tosef is to make a new mitzvah and say it's daraisa. You know, clearly we have no mitzvah, we have didim derabbanan, we have minhagim, and that's not a problem. But to have something else and say it's daraisa is a problem of Bal Tosef. But to take upon a personal practice is probably not going to fit any of the definitions. But it is an intricate topic, which we're not really doing justice to. So far, how many we said? Four positions so far. So another one would be a very useful one. This one actually helps us. That maybe you can fast, but you can fast half a day. You can't fast, but you can fast half a day. So that's helpful because on Shabbos, we don't allow that. On Shabbos, we ask that you fast, not only you not fast, but you're not fast even half a day. So that means we require you to eat before chatzos. So depending on what minyan you daven in, that's harder or easier. If you daven in an early minyan on Shabbos, so you go home and you make kiddush before chatzos, so it's no problem. If the minyan continues before chatzos, so then you have to deal with it somehow, have some water before davening, something like that, to make sure you're not in a state of tainus when chatzos comes. So Rosh Hashanah, that's a much more complicated problem because pretty much all of us daven past chatzos, unless you're really in an extreme circumstance where it's not possible for you. Almost every minyan in the world is going to daven past chatzos, because even if it's an early minyan, so it says in the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah that you should keep it going until chatzos. So this is the time of judgment. Probably the ideal time, most of us don't really do this, probably the ideal time to daven on Rosh Hashanah would be to get up already by Netzach HaMelech. We had this idea of not sleeping during the time of judgment, you know, really to daven Vasikin, and then to schlep it out until Chatzos, that this is the time of judgment. So that would be really the best way to do it. Now again, most of us don't do that, we get up a little later, and we don't have a problem getting it to go past Chatzos, it happens naturally. So since really everyone's going to be in Shul till Chatzos and Rosh Hashanah, it's a more complex issue. So the notion that maybe there isn't an Isser Tainus in that sense, that there is on Shabbos, that's a helpful possibility. A sixth opinion, the Shita Mekubetzet in Beitza, suggests that only Tzadikim and Gedolei Hador have a special right. They're worried about the whole community. They're taking on the whole world on their shoulders. They have the right to fast on Rosh Hashanah, but the average Pashut Yid like us, so we're not able to fast on Rosh Hashanah. Hi.
What about eating before Tekiah Shofar?
So eating before Tekiah Shofar is a very complex question, which deserves a whole topic in itself, so we can't go into it in that great length, but it relates to the previous sheet, to this idea that we're concerned about fast. We may or may not be concerned about fasting until Chatzos. It's a very complex question, what do you do about Tekiah Shofar? Really, we strongly prefer that we don't eat at all before Tekiah Shofar. But we're balancing various things. We're balancing surviving. We're balancing the possible issue of fasting, if you believe there's an issue, which again is our focus. And on the other hand, a strong desire not to eat too much before Tekiah Shofar. It's something that Poskim argued back and forth about vehemently on both sides. The different practices in yeshivas, they have different practices. Any yeshivas, they make kiddush before Tekiah Shofar and give you very small amounts. Rabbi Avner did this and they cut all the cakes. So it should all be less than the kibbutz. That's a big job. It's not an easy question, and it deserves its own discussion. But one of the factors that goes into that discussion about whether you'll decide to make kiddush before Tekiah Shofar or not, and again there are those who are very opposed to that and there are those who are less opposed to that, would be this question of, is there a problem of fasting before Chatzos, that's fasting until Chatzos, which is also thrown into the mix, which, so that discussion we're not ready to have right now, but just this element is relevant to it, so we'll throw that out.
I'm just going to mention that there are Nates Minyanim at the Kotel, Yerushalmi, I mean, these are not modern, they daven, and they basically finish way before Chatzos.
And they stop completely.
And they stop, and they go home, and they make Kiddush, and they do whatever they do.
So that could be motivated by a concern that it,
I mean, when I say they finish, I'm saying that they start davening obviously before, way before nights, because they're davening Vasikin. They daven for about 4.5 hours. By 9:30, they're on their way home.
That's impressive. But you do find in you do find in the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah this idea that you should be mirech b'piyutim v'tachnunim until chatzos. So most of us, again, that's an exception, maybe, but most of us will probably be in shul at least that long. Hi.
Yes, I wanted to know this whole notion that we're talking about of not eating or fasting at least until chatzos. Would this include what most people do, including me, having tea or juice before I begin even breakfast?
Right, so probably
because
not.
Because otherwise I feel that I don't have the ability and the power to be up in that oven
to survive
for 3 hours.
Understood.
And daven and speak and read the Torah. I just can't do it. Yom Kippur, I have no choice.
Right. Understood.
But I don't want to subject myself.
Got it.
On Rosh Hashanah.
So,
how do you? What do the Rishonim feel about
so
it?
Would
they look down upon me and say, Horatsky is a Rasha?
I doubt it. I don't know that much about you, but I doubt it. this question is concerned. We're usually mekel about tea and coffee as far as normal Shabbos and Tov. But Rosh Hashanah is an additional issue. It's not only the davening issue. We're probably going to cut it at this point to move to other points. But there is, in addition to davening, there's a question of shofar, the mitzvah that's relevant. So it's a little bit of a more complicated question than it is on the average Shabbos and Tov. But again, I think when it comes to tea and coffee, before the general attitude is more likely to be mekel. We should probably, on that note, move to other discussions. So in any case, no problem. So in any case, we have these six views. So that leaves us more confused than we started, right? So we didn't know, we never put a direction before we began. We tried to look to the halacha to get a direction, and we ended up in six different directions. Hi.
Do you have a chiyuv to make kiddush on Rosh Hashanah? Because if so, then how would you fast if you're not going to end up making kiddush?
So that's a good question. So maybe you make kiddush at night. Kiddush at night is always more chamer than kiddush during the day. So maybe you assume that that's it. No one says you're going to fast the whole time. The only question is fasting during the day. So we're left without a clear direction. So what do we do? So let's look for some more clues. So food for once has failed us. So to move on to davening. Do you see a clue in davening? Right? So there is a question that there are certain texts that we insert into our davening on Moadim that reflect the idea of simcha. The text of Bahatzigenu that we recite on Yontif. And in Kiddush, we have a phrase, we have certain terminologies that we insert into our davening that refer to Sasan and Simcha. So should that be recited on Rosh Hashanah? So once again, what's the answer to the question? It's Machlokas. If you look in the Rosh and the Sefer Rosh Hashanah, he quotes Machlokas on this point, he quotes from the Torah, he goes back and forth, and the Shulchan Aruch, Haskins on this issue, so maybe we'll go a little direction. Shulchan Aruch tells us to omit these phrases. So again, this issue put us into a machlokas again. So maybe the Shulchan Aruch helps us out a little bit by telling us, okay, here's the answer. Leave out these phrases in davening. Problem is, the same Shulchan Aruch, if you go back to our previous question about eating, so Shulchan Aruch says, Ochlin v'shosin v'smeichim. You should eat and you should drink and be merry on Rosh Hashanah. So we thought maybe we got a little bit of direction here, but now the Shulchan Aruch kind of takes us back again because he passes both ways. So once again, clue number two, we're still not totally there. We're still kind of confused. So let's give it a third try. Right? If first you don't succeed, try a second time, try a third time. So still within the realm of davening, there is the question of Hallel. So Hallel, do we recite Hallel on Rosh Hashanah? It's not in my focus, right? We don't recite Hallel on Rosh Hashanah. That we're pretty agreed upon. But it's an interesting discussion, why not? So the Gemara says in Maseches Erechim and Daf Yud that this is something that the angels are going to point out is not in our favor. They say, God, are you really so impressed with these people, with these Jews? They don't even bother to say Hallel, give them Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, such an amazing opportunity. They don't even think this is worth praising you. They don't even think it's worth saying Hallel in response. So Kadosh Baruch Hu says, what do you expect from them? They know what they're doing. Sifrei Chayim v'Sifrei Meisim Suchim Ofanav. Kadosh Baruch Hu is sitting up there in judgment. Melech Malchei Hamlachim is sitting up there in judgment, and the Book of Life and the Book of Death are open in front of him. So you think they're going to say Hallel at such a time? You think that's possible? It makes sense. It's understandable. They're not going to recite Hallel on these days. So how to read that Gemara is an interesting question. Seems to suggest they're really on its own. We could have had Hallel, but Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur did, in theory, merit Hallel, and that's what the angels are arguing against us, that they're neglecting this obligation of Hallel. But it was modified, it was muted by the mood of the day. The mood of the day came and stifled the natural instinct to say Hallel. So from that Gemara, again, we have somewhat of a direction, but it's an in-between direction. That there was Simcha, there is Simcha, but the Simcha is being stifled, is being muted by other elements of the day. The Rambam, when he codifies this halachas, he puts a little bit of a different spin on it, perhaps takes it in a little bit of a different direction, in Hilchas Chanukah. So he tells us that, tells us the whole list of the days in which you say Hallel and which you don't. He lists off all the different days, you say Hallel on these days, and you don't say Hallel, he says, on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, because these are days of Eima and Ira and Pachad and Tshuva, and they're not days of Simcha, Yisera. So you thought you were going somewhere and then it turns around. They're not days of Simcha that much. And so he almost gave us a clear ruling. No Simcha on Rosh Hashanah, a lot. So that seems to suggest that it's somewhere in between. It's a little bit of a different spin than the Gemara gave us. It's a little bit of a different perspective, where the Gemara was saying, kind of, apparently was saying, yes, there's Simcha, but be quiet because the jury's still out. So the Rambam seems to be saying there's Simcha, it doesn't quite get there. Right? And that's how the Brisker Rav understood it, that apparently it's not just any level of Simcha that justifies Hallel, that Hallel requires a certain threshold of Simcha, and we're not you're not quite there on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. There is Simcha, it's not all the way to the point that we need it to be. So that at least gives us a homework assignment. At least it gives us some room to try to figure out what's going on within a certain context. That apparently there is Simcha, we have to figure out to what degree and of what nature. So basically, to our investigation so far, so we looked at the question of Suda, the permissibility of fasting. We saw six different opinions. We looked at the question of davening, the text we recite in davening, and we saw different opinions in the Shulchan Aruch paskening in apparently contradictory ways as far as these two questions. And then we saw the question of Hallel, where the Gemara gives us the impression of conflicting forces, and the Rambam gives us the impression of a level of Simcha that doesn't go all the way. Just mention quickly a few other areas of halacha that might be affected by this question, whatever conclusion we come to. These are not necessarily things that come up in our everyday life, more obscure issues. For example, if you know anybody who's planning on having their wedding on Rosh Hashanah, if you manage to find time, they go to one of the early Nates Minyanim and they get home by 9, they schedule their wedding during the afternoon. So that's definitely not recommended. The question is, besides the fact it's hard to get your guests together, but it's definitely going to be prohibited. The question is it prohibited midaraisa, or is it prohibited midrabana, or both? So the paradox of this issue is interesting. Normally we assume that the prohibitions that we associate with Shabbos are more chamor, more stringent than the prohibitions we associate with chalmoid. Chalmoid, there is a prohibition of malacha, but it's on a different level. We normally assume that there are things that are, many things that are permitted on chalmoid that are not permitted on Shabbos. This is an interesting paradox. Actually, to get married on a Chol Hamoed Sukkos is probably worse than to get married on Shabbos. Because on a Chol Hamoed Sukkos, so you have an issue. Talmud tells us, Ein Arbit Simcha v'Simcha. We're not permitted to mix two Simchas. Each one would dilute the other. And the Gemara derives that from a Pasuk. The Pasuk says, V'samachta v'chageach, a Pasuk mentioned earlier, we are told to rejoice in the Yontif, and says the Gemara, V'lo v'ishtucha, not in your personal marriage Simcha. So the way we've shown him understand, that's a real drasha min haTorah, that's a real prohibition min haTorah. It's an interesting aside that the Talmud Yerushalmi has a different source for this, and the Talmud Yerushalmi learns it from Lavan. that Lavan told Yaakov. Malay Shmuel goes, Yaakov wanted to, when in school we learn this as kids, we don't always understand what's going on. That we think that Yaakov worked 7 years to marry Leah, and then he had to wait another 7 years to marry Rachel. We don't look at the Psukim. In the Psukim we see that's not exactly what happens. That he has to work another 7 years afterwards, but he's allowed to marry Rachel immediately after Leah, except that Lavan says, not immediately, wait a week, don't mix the Shavar Brachas. Let them finish the Shavar Brachas first for Leah, and then you can have then you can marry Rachel. So the Yerushalmi understands from there that there is a concept of Eim Ha'arav and Simcha B'Simcha. We don't want to mix the two Shavar Brachas. So a fascinating idea to learn halachas from Lavan. So if you're interested in that, if you're interested in that question, so the Torah Tamima has a commentary on the Siddur called Baruch Shemar, and in the first, I think the first piece, in the beginning of the Sefer Baruch Shemar, he has a discussion about this. Why is it relevant there? Because we start off davening in the morning with Matovu, which is a quotation from Bilam. So this idea of quoting from Bilam, of learning from Lavan, there's an interesting discussion about this in the Teretz Mimah Sefer and the Siddur. In many cases, the Bavli learns it from this pasuk, V'samachta v'chagecha, and that's understood by Rishon, posting Subas writes, and other Rishon understands to be a real Issum and HaTorah. So to get married on Sukkot, even Chol HaMoed Sukkot, when you might think, well, I can get my guests to get to drive to the wedding, it won't be as much of a problem. But nonetheless, there is an issue of Eim Ha'arav and Simcha B'Simcha. So on Shabbos, you don't really have that issue. On Shabbos, we mostly assume that there is not an obligation of Simcha. There are minority opinions that there is. The general view is that Simcha is a Yontif obligation. It's not a Shabbos obligation. Shabbos, there are other factors in play, but Simcha is not one of them. So therefore, there probably isn't a problem with Eim Ha'arav and Simcha B'Simcha in getting married on Shabbos. There's an Issur Rabbanan. There's an Issur. Anything in the heading of Kinyanim is prohibited on Shabbos. It's a Gezeirah because of Kosev. We're concerned about writing. We don't want you to do things that will bring about the need to write. And therefore, we prohibit across the board all Kinyanim. And that includes weddings. So to get married on Shabbos is an Issur Rabbanan, this Gezeirah that's meant to protect Kosev. So what about Rosh Hashanah? So maybe we'll try to finish the point. What about Rosh Hashanah? So can one get married in Rosh Hashanah on a level Min HaTorah or Midrabanan? So that would seem to be relevant to this, that if we assume that Simcha is applicable to Rosh Hashanah, so then it's an Issur D'oraisa to get married. It's a more serious problem. If it's a question of a no Simcha, so then it's a problem Midrabanan. And that may make a difference every once in a while, but it's probably not so likely to impact on our personal lives. Another issue, which is also a little more likely to be relevant, but the concern is a little more vague, has to do with the bris milah. So a bris milah, so we know if a bris is on the eighth day, everything is in order. So then the bris takes place no matter what, whether it's Yom Kippur, whether it's Rosh Hashanah, whether it's whatever day of the year. But there is a factor which is worth discussing, that this is an obligation on the father. The father has the obligation to make sure the bris happens on the eighth day, no matter what. But that's not necessarily the obligation of the mole. If the father lives in Antarctica, and the bris is going to take place in the middle of a three-day yontif, and the mole lives in beautiful Washington Heights, and the father says, okay, listen, Moel, I need you to come to my bris, so you need to leave your family for Yontif and come to Antarctica for a three-day Yontif so you can perform my bris in the middle. So the Moel has the right to say, I mean, in general, he has the right to make his own decisions, and there are other factors involved, but the Moel has the right to say, I have a chi of Simchas Yontif. I'm not going to abandon my family, abandon Washington Heights for a three-day Yontif so I can come to Antarctica for your bris. You know, you have to deal with it somehow, but that's not my problem. That's how the Avinazer explains. The Avinazer Meshubas writes that point, that there is the ability, there is the factor of Simchas Yontif, which the Moel has to worry about as well. So the Minchas Yitzchak, more recently, Diane Weiss, and Diane Yerushalayim, in his Shubas discussed this question in relation to Rosh Hashanah. So at the same point, what if you have the three-day Rosh Hashanah, and the bris is in Antarctica? So when you're adding up the factors, so can the Moel come and say, well, I got my Simchas Yontif to worry about? The father will say, no, it's not true. No Simcha in Rosh Hashanah. So who's right? So that debate will be affected by this question. So that's why the Minchas Yitzchak talks about this question. He's analyzing this issue of, does a Moel who doesn't want to leave home for Yontif, does he claim Simchas Yontif from Rosh Hashanah? Or is that a factor that's only relevant to the other Yom Tov? Another point that Achronim discuss, that there is a Gemara at the beginning of Maseches Matkatan, which says that it's inappropriate to have, let's say, a special memorial service, to have a special hesped too close to a yantif, within a month before a yantif, that's considered a, there's two reasons in the Gemara why this is, but at least one of them seems to suggest that it's an issue of impinging on the Simchas Yantif of the day. So this is also a discussion Post can have in the Shailas and Tshuvas, Hisarvis Tshuva, there's a discussion about this, that how would that affect Rosh Hashanah? Is this something that's relevant to Rosh Hashanah as well? Or no, Rosh Hashanah doesn't have Simcha and it's not applicable to that day. So those are just parenthetically a few other points. Once we figure out our direction here, may or may not be affected by this question. So what do we do with all our clues? So where are we on this question? Is there a chiyuv of Simcha and Rosh Hashanah, or is there not? So let's go back to the Shulchan Aruch, which confused us. The Shulchan Aruch took us in two different directions. Now on the question of the Nusach HaTfilah, so Shulchan Aruch told us not to recite these phrases of Sasan and Simcha. But on the other hand, the Shulchan Aruch did tell us in the first question about eating, Ochlin v'shosin v'smeich. So how do we resolve that? What's going on? So this was taken up by a contemporary sefer, the Belzer Dai in Eretz Yisrael. His name is Rav Shammai Kahatz Gross. So he wrote a sefer of Shailos and Tshuvas called Shevet HaKahasim. So in that sefer, so he discusses this question. He discusses how do you reconcile this psak of the Shulchan Aruch. And he points you to a comment in the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon, in his commentary to Megillas Esther, tells us a distinction between the phrases, the words, the sasin and simcha. That's a popular topic as far as discussed. We know these words often appear in our liturgy and yantif related. So what exactly is the definition of sasin as opposed to simcha and the other way around? Now, there are a number of theories, but the way the Vilna Gaon seems to understand it is that sasin is feeling joy right now. You're feeling joy in the moment and what you're experiencing at present, that is sasin. Simcha, if I'm interpreting it correctly, simcha is more a type of serenity, that you're happy in the situation, perhaps you're anticipating happiness, but it's not necessarily that you're enjoying things right now. And to go back to seeing the world through the prism of food, so use a model of food, so when you're enjoying a steak right now, so that's comparable to sasa. You are taking the bite right now, you're getting the schmuck out of it, that's joy, that's sasa right now. Then there's another type of happiness where you're not actually eating the steak right now, but you know that you have easy access to steak. That you know that you're living in a town where you get free steaks every once in a while, and pretty soon you'll have one, and then pretty soon after that you'll have another one. There'll always be a steady supply of steaks. So right now you're not enjoying the steak at the moment. You're not in a state of currently feeling that joy. But if you feel you're a happy man because somebody asks you, how are things going? Great, I'm going to have a steak tomorrow night, another one the day after. Everything's wonderful. So you're not in the state of joy right now, but you're happy. You're happy. You're serene, perhaps is the right word, a state of serenity, that you know that the steaks are free flowing. So too, these concepts are relevant here, that there is a concept of sasana which requires you to feel joy right now. That concept is applicable to the regala. It's a concept that's relevant for sure to Sukkot. And we know Chazal always emphasized especially the Simcha component of Sukkot even more than everything else. And Pesach and Shavuos, so there is this obligation of Sason in the day. When it comes to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, there is Simcha, but it's different. It's not Sason. It's not that you're told to enjoy the moment right now. And in fact, the moment, there are tensions, there's anxieties associated with the day. The nature of the Simcha on Rosh Hashanah, he suggests, is that one should feel serene, so to speak. One should feel a sense of happiness coming from a confidence that this season's going to work out. That if you go through the process and you do everything right, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is responsive, so then things will ultimately be good. And therefore, that awareness is what we're looking for on Rosh Hashanah. And that's a different type of Simcha. So it's not properly termed Sason and Simcha, and we leave those phrases out of our davening. That's not what it's about. It's not about feeling Sason and Simcha right now. It's about a sense of serenity in the overall situation, a sense of bitachon that going through the procedure properly will bring you to a good place, and that this will be a good situation ultimately. That perhaps is the type of Simcha that we're looking for. And that could explain why the Shulchan Aruch tells us that yes, we should eat, we should drink, but we leave out the phrases of sasa and simcha. Now this idea that we should eat and that we should drink. So it's just interesting to look in general at how that works when it comes to a normal yontif. When it comes to a normal yontif, so really in Minhag Torah, the obligation of Simchas Yontif requires a vote in the Beis HaMikdash, requires a Aliyah LeRegel and the Shalmei Simcha, and we don't have that nowadays. So the Gemara tells us in a couple places we don't have that type of simcha, so we have more mundane physical simchas that we relate to in our current setting. It's different things for different people. Like the Gemara says, men tend to like meat and wine, and women tend to like new clothing, and children tend to like candies. So whatever it is, each to its own taste. So that's what we do nowadays. It's a little bit of a question in Rishonim between the Rambam and Tosfos and Lord Cardin, whether we are in fulfillment of Simchas Yontif Min HaTorah nowadays with these alternative avenues, or maybe we don't even have Simchas Yontif Min HaTorah, and maybe that's only done in the Beis HaMikdash, and what we do nowadays is a Drabbanim. That's a Machlokas Rishonim. Something also that the Shagas Aryeh takes up at great length in the piece before he talks about Rosh Hashanah. So that's a question. I mean, that's how we relate to mitzvah of Simchas Yontif nowadays. So what does Simchas Yontif mean for us? We don't go to the Beis HaMikdash, we don't necessarily go to Yerushalayim. So what does Simchas Yontif mean for us? Let's say it means this meal on Yontif, the meals on Yontif. So what exactly is the mechanism by which that operates? So Rabbi Soloveitchik is quoting a number of Svarim as explaining, and this is a principle that he has in a number of different mitzvos, but actually a few of them are relevant to the Rosh Hashanah and Kippur season. It's interesting. A couple of different examples of this type of mechanism come up in the context of this period. But when it comes to Simchas Yontif, this is an especially relevant structure. Explain the Rav that normally when you do a mitzvah, so you do the action of the mitzvah, and the fulfillment of the mitzvah comes at the same time. Right? So you have a mitzvah to eat matzah. So that means you eat the matzah as the action, and you fulfill the mitzvah matzah at the same time. You have a mitzvah to take a lulav, so you take the lulav and you do that action and you fulfill the mitzvah at the same time. But there are a handful of mitzvahs, there are a few mitzvahs which don't work that way, where you do one action and the fulfillment comes through something else that was hopefully brought about by that action. And it's particularly relevant when we talk about emotionally based mitzvahs. And you have something like v'samachta v'chagecha. So the Torah tells you feel an emotion. So how can we control our emotions, turn them on, turn them off? So it's hard to believe, as the way many understand, it's hard to believe that it means that exactly, that our responsibility right now is to push a button and be happy. So rather, we interpret it to mean that we are supposed to do actions which are likely to bring about happiness. That is the Maisa HaMitzvah. And having done those actions, and hopefully we'll be happy, that is the Kiyum HaMitzvah. The fulfillment of the mitzvah comes from the emotional response. So we have an action, and that will be, let's say, the meal and the drinking on Yontif. And the response that comes from that, the emotional happiness that comes as a result, so that is the key of Hamid. So normally, when it comes to Yontif, so Yontif, we have this obligation to eat, and that's what we do. We do it in order to bring about the proper mood that is required by the day. And to fast on Yontif would pretty much, by definition, be a contradiction to that mood, pretty much make it impossible for most people to feel the type of simcha that we're looking for on that day. Now, when it comes to Rosh Hashanah, we see that there is a slightly different angle, that there is simcha, but it's not the same. It's not the same type of simcha. We're not necessarily looking that you should be having a good time right now. Fasting would be pretty much incompatible with having a good time right now, but that's not necessarily what we're looking for. We're looking for the sense of serenity, the sense of general happiness. So for most people, eating is also conducive to that. Eating is conducive to that as well. So therefore, it probably, for most people, manifest itself in a similar way. That the obligation of Suda that we have on Yontif to bring about a Pesach type of Simcha, so it's the same process on Rosh Hashanah to bring about a Rosh Hashanah type of Simcha. However, there are exceptions as well. And to illustrate that exception, so we could look to Shabbos. And Shabbos, so we don't fast. It's for a different reason. It's not because of Simcha, as we alluded to earlier, that probably is no concept of Simcha on Shabbos. Shabbos, we're guided by Oneg. It's a pasuk in Sefer Yeshayahu, Mitzvah Taseh Medivrei Kabbalah, Mitzvah from the Nevi'im, that we have a concept of Oneg and Kavod on Shabbos. and probably not simcha. And then the question going back on yontif, is there an obligation of owning? Many rishonim assume there's no owning on yontif. It's a good trivia question. If anybody asks you to name some svarim that may not exist, at least two svarim may not exist. The Kedushas Levi, the Shaila and Poskim, whether there is a Kedusha to a Levi, and maybe only the Kedushas Kohen.
And
Oneg Yontif. There's a popular statement of Chashuva Sefer of Shalas and Shuvas called the Shuvas Oneg Yontif. And the concept may not exist. We're not sure if there is a Oneg. Shuvas definitely exists. The svarim are a wonderful svarim, but the titles may not exist. So Oneg Yontif is a question. Oneg Shabbos we know we have. So Oneg Shabbos, so again, it's another situation where both cases, it manifests itself in a Chi of Suda, but for different reasons. So Shabbos, we're not allowed to fast because we're looking for a pleasant time. That's what Oneg probably directly translates into. And fast would be basically incompatible with having a pleasant time.
Is Oneg Sasson that corresponds to
Sasson? No, not really. It's a different type. Sasson is joy. And Oneg is pleasant. We have to give more substance to that definition. But for now, we're gonna rely on that. Oneg is a slightly different type of mood. Now, normally we don't allow fasting on Yom Kippur. We don't allow fasting on Shabbos unless it's Yom Kippur. And the one exception that we fast on Shabbos is when Yom Kippur falls out of Shabbos. Then we fast. And normally we don't. And we know Tisha B'Av and Shavuot B'Tamuz very frequently fall out on Shabbos. And we push it off. We don't allow the fast take place on Shabbos. We fast on Sunday. There is a view in Rishonim that Asar B'Tavis would also be observed on Shabbos. But that's not so relevant to us for two reasons. First of all, we probably don't accept that view. And second of all, calendarically, it never happens. Calendarically, our calendar is set up that our Asar B'Tavis never falls out on Shabbos. So practically,
it does fall out on Friday,
right?
Once in a while, which
is unusual because normally we don't fast on Friday either. So there, the unusual aspect of Asar B'Tavis does manifest itself. But for the most part, the only time we're going to fast on Shabbos is in Kippur. The Gemara mentions one other exception, that there is a concept of a tainus chalom. The Gemara tells us in Maseches Tainus and Daf Yud Aleph that if a person has a bad dream in the middle of the night, and people have different levels of sensitivity to dreams, people take them in different ways, but if somebody is very upset by a dream, it doesn't correlate to anything he was talking about during the day, it's completely out of nowhere, and it has a very negative message to it. So if somebody wakes up in the morning and he's all disturbed because of this dream, he thinks it may portend something, he thinks it may have some meaning to it. So the Gemara says, well, a good suggestion for that, says, Yafa tainis l'chalom ke'ishl na'aretz, that a fast has an effect on a dream like fire does to flax. The way fire will burn right through flax, so too a dream will be taken care of completely by fasting. That's a great idea if you want to take care of a bad dream. So a tainis cholam is a good idea. And the Gemara says it's different than other tainesim, that normally if you want to take upon yourself a personal tainis, it's not calendarically ordained, it's not there already on the schedule, you want to take upon a personal tainis. So the Gemara right over there also, when the Afidala tells us that the way you do it is you have to accept it from the day before. You might think that if you get up late in the morning and you have to run out of the house and they don't have time for breakfast, and then you work through lunch and it's the winter and it's going to be shki at 4 o'clock. So I think it's already 2 o'clock and I haven't had a chance to eat anything yet. So I'll hold it out for another 2 hours and boom, it's an active tshuva. It's a good fast that I just scored that day. So the Gemara says that's not the way to go. That has to be intentional. You have to say the day before, at mincha the day before, you have to accept the tainus upon yourself, and then it's meaningful when you don't eat the next day. But the Gemara says this is an exception, that time is chalom, so the fast should take place that day. You wake up in the morning, you realize you had the dream the night before, you should fast immediately. And then the Gemara surprises us and tells us, even on Shabbos, you should have such a fast, even though we don't allow fasting normally on Shabbos, but if this is the event, so then we would tell you to fast even on Shabbos. Well, the Gemara does say that you're going to have to fast again later to do tshuva for having fasted on Shabbos. It's not a wonderful thing, but still that's the recommendation, to fast on Shabbos. So the Rishonim explain, the Farshim explain what's going on there. So basically, did we override Shabbos? And we have a Chi of Oneg on Shabbos, which tells us that we have to eat. And this Tainus Chalom overrode Shabbos and nullified this obligation? So they explain, no, that's not what happens. That what does Oneg mean? Oneg means having a pleasant time. So for 99.99% of all people. So fasting is completely inconsistent with having a good time. It's impossible to have a good time and be fasting at the same time. So therefore, we have to eat on Shabbos. We can't be fasting. That is a direct contradiction to Oneg. But you could, in theory, have someone who's in a position where that's not the case. You have somebody who's so disturbed about the dream that they had the night before, they're so upset about it, and they're going to have this wonderful lunch spread out in front of them and a wonderful Shalosh Shiras and a wonderful Kiddush, and they say, I can't think about that. I'm so upset at this dream. I'm so worried about what's going to happen. I can't go to the Kiddush. I can't have the challenge. I can't have the goal. I can't think about that right now. I'm thinking about the dream. So then you're going to tell this person, well, you know what? If you fast, then that'll help the dream. So I'll say, really? Okay, then all the better. So I'll fast and I'll be and I'll relieve this tension. So it could be for this person, even though everyone else, for sure, they have to eat in order to achieve oneg. But this person will have a better oneg if they fast than if they eat. It's still not perfect because it just means he's equal to a normal day. Right? And he's not as anguished as he was. The fast deals with the anguish, but he's still left pretty hungry. So that's why I think Gemara said we should make up this, do a fast for this fast, because it's not perfect, but you take away this great impediment that's in the way. Maybe we'll listen to the question answer, but we're going to run out of time. So this could be relevant here as well, that we see that when it comes to Shabbos, look at the model of Shabbos, so we have really an obligation to eat, we have a prohibition to fast, because that's normally the path to Oneg. But in theory, there could be an exception, there could be a small percentage of the population for which the path to Oneg is in the opposite direction. And when it comes to Rosh Hashanah, it could be that that's true as well. When it comes to Rosh Hashanah, so most of us, the vast majority of people, are told to eat. That eating is something that will bring about the type of simcha on Rosh Hashanah that we're looking for, even though it's different than the type of simcha we're looking for in Pesach. Still, the same root will likely put us in the right frame of mind. But you could have somebody who's going to say, that's not how I'm feeling right now. I know that I want to have confidence in my Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur experience, but in order to do that, I need another gesture of tshuva. I need another fast day right now. Then maybe I could feel more confident. But right now, I don't feel like I'm in a place where I can have this type of simcha. I feel like I have to really do something. And maybe, therefore, this fast will be conducive to that. So maybe that's a valid argument. Maybe such a person can make this case after that. The type of simcha they're looking for, so fasting is more conducive. When it comes to Pesach, you can't say that, because Pesach, you have to have a good time right now. So to be fasting on Pesach is going to be a direct contradiction to the sasan of Pesach. But on Rosh Hashanah, we're not telling you have to have sasan right now, we're telling you to have this mentality of simcha, and that's something that perhaps, at least for an individual who feels this way, might be that fasting is more conducive. So just to discuss for a minute, because we put officially in the title Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we should mention how Yom Kippur relates to this. So our instinct is that, we start off with the whole question of whether it's a Chiyuv Suda or Nesar Tainus. So our instinct would probably be to say, so clearly Yom Kippur is not on this discussion. Clearly Yom Kippur, there's probably a mission to fast. There's no Chiyuv Suda on Yom Kippur. But the truth is, it's not such an obvious point. One could say, thematically, that really the mood on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur is the same, and that there should be a Chiyuv Suda on Yom Kippur. Just there's a big technical problem. There's a big technical problem that you can have karis if you get involved in Suda and Yom Kippur. But thematically, it could be that it does make sense. And you do find this in Rishonim as well. It's just it's a whole topic in itself. Maybe we'll just quickly mention it. So you know that there is an obligation to eat on Erev Yom Kippur. The Gemara tells us in the first parak of Brachos, the last parak of Truma, that we've learned out from Pesukim, that there is a mitzvah to eat on Erev Yom Kippur. It's a question of what that mitzvah is about. Different views in Rishonim. If you look in later Svarim, you'll find many very different views, a lot of interesting Kabbalistic theories as to what exactly is going on, a lot of very creative Pulitzer suggestions. But in the Rishonim, you find basically two directions as to why this obligation is involved. You look in the Rush and Yuma, and you look in Rashi and Rosh Hashanah. And if you look in Rabbeinu Yonah in the Shari Tshuva happens to list a lot of the views in Rishonim and Shari Tshuva about this topic. So you see basically two schools of thought. There are those who say it's a preparation for the Tainus, that you shouldn't clock on Yom Kippur. You should make sure to eat before. Within that, there's a It's a different view that it's actually to prepare for the tainus and making it harder. The Torah Tzimima discusses that possibility, that maybe we want that there should be an even more intense experience on the Kippur. And if you go from a point of greater indulgence to a point of fasting, it's even more intense. And maybe that's the idea. That's a minority view within the school of thought, that it's basically a preparation for the fast. And then there's another school of thought that it's there because of Simchas Yontif, that really Yom Kippur there should be a Suda. Yom Kippur is Yontif of Yom Tovim, and there should be an obligation of a Suda. But again, we have this technical problem, so what do? So we push it up. We have the Suda before Yom Kippur in fulfillment of the obligation of a Suda on Yom Kippur. It's not perfect, it's not on the day itself, but it's not so off base. And we have other proofs from Rishonim in different contexts that there is such a concept of having a Suda in honor of something, not necessarily on the day, but close to it. So to have the Suda before Yom Kippur can be a reflection of Simchas Yontif of Yom Kippur. So therefore, that is very possible that Yom Kippur really shares the mood. And that's what the Sefer Yerayim writes. Sefer Yerayim writes that really Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur have the same type of atmosphere, but that the Chi of Tainus comes and gets in the way. But the mood is still the same when it comes to Yom Kippur. I'll mention quickly, there is an interesting tshuva of Akiva Eger. Again, this issue of fasting, of eating on Erev Yom Kippur is one that we could talk about for a long time, except that we don't have a long time. Just mention quickly that there is a tshuva of Akiva Eger discusses, and he's asked a question about a woman who was sick and did not plan on fasting on Yom Kippur because of her condition. So the question was, does she have a chiyuv to eat on Erev Yom Kippur? Well, kind of a weird type of question, a type of chola who needs to eat on Yom Kippur but needs to not eat the day before. I don't know exactly what the type of condition that is. But that was the question. This person is not going to be fasting on Yom Kippur for medical reasons. So does she have an obligation to eat on Erev Yom Kippur? So he responded that it seems like she's off the hook either way, because we have these two basic views in Rishon, that it's there to prepare for the fast, or it's a special mitzvah reflection of Simchas Yontif. So if it's there to prepare for the fast, so then somebody who's a cholah who's not fasting perhaps should be potter. So then that's how that question would play out. And if it's there as a reflection of Simchas Yontif, so what do we have? We have a positive mitzvah that's tied to Yontif. Basically, it's a mitzvah saseh, shahazman grama. So women should be potter. So I'm just trying to finish the point before we run out of time. So mitzvah saseh, shahazman grama, so women should be potter. So, like you said, this woman, she's potter either way. So she's a woman and she's a chola. So as a chola, so she's probably potter if it's a preparation for the fast. And as an isha, she's potter from mitzvah say she has mangrama. So either understanding that you take to this mitzvah, even if we don't decide which one it is, she's probably potter either way. So to say that Yom Kippur is not in this cheshbon is not necessarily true. Yom Kippur probably does have the same mood of Rosh Hashanah. And the technical issue that gets in the way, but maybe we deal with that technical issue by pushing up the Suda. So we're just about out of time, just to quickly review what we spoke about. So we spoke about this question of what is the nature of Rosh Hashanah. Is the phrase Happy New Year a relevant phrase, or is it irrelevant? So we discussed the first looking at the fact that on the one hand it's a Yontif, and on the other hand it's a Yontif, and it's also a time of Slicha, so it seems to be happy. On the other hand, there's no Shami Simcha, and there's a certain tension, so it seems to be less happy. So we tried to look at the question of food, is there a Chiyuv Suda, and we saw, is there an Isser Kindness, and we saw six views, that you are not allowed to fast, you're allowed to fast, and you should fast, you're allowed to fast, and you can fast. You can fast only the second day, maybe because of Rosh Chodesh, maybe because of Daraisa. You can fast half a day, you can fast only if you're a special tzaddik gadol ador. So not having resolved it from there, we looked at different clues. So we looked at the question of davening, do you recite Mahasiyenu, do you recite Sasan Simcha? So our 2 days from Rishonim, the Shulchan Aruch passes not to say these phrases, even though Shulchan Aruch says that you should eat and drink and be merry. So the question, how do we resolve that? And we looked at the issue of Hallel. Halal, the Gemara says you should say, but Sefer Chaim has been days of cycles, and the Rambam says you shouldn't say because there's not days of Simcha. Yaseir, as Rabbi Skrov pointed out, apparently was falling below the threshold of Simcha. And pointed out other possible nafkaminas, the question of whether getting married on Rosh Hashanah is an Issa Deraisa or an Issa Derabban, is there an issue of Bema Arvin Simcha the Simcha? The question whether a Moel can claim his own Simcha Siyatik on Rosh Hashanah is a reason not to go do somebody's bris, and the question of whether there's an Issa to set up this memorial service before Rosh Hashanah, is it impinging on the Simcha Siyatik or is it to worry about. And then we tried to resolve the question between the Shulchan Aruch, why he passes to eat and drink but at the same time, flee by the phrase of Sasan and Simcha. We mentioned that Shuva Shevra Kahasi, he quotes the Gra, the difference between Sasan and Simcha. Sasan is happiness in the moment, and Simcha is serenity in the situation in general. And therefore, there's no Sasan and Simcha in Rosh Hashanah, but there is Simcha, and that's why we eat. And we discussed the relationship between eating and Simcha Siyantiv, how eating is the Maisa mitzvah to bring about the Kiyum of Simcha, and that's normally the way Yantiv operates. And Rosh Hashanah probably operates in the same way. But since it's a slightly different mood, there might be different circumstances. And we looked at the model of Shabbos, where we saw Shabbos is a chiyuv oneg, which requires us to eat. But nonetheless, there could be an exception. If you have a kind of chalom, so then the oneg of fasting for the chalom might overtake the oneg of eating. So too on Rosh Hashanah. So normally for most people, the simcha of Rosh Hashanah comes from eating. But if you think that you're looking for this serenity, you're looking for this confidence, you're not going to get it unless you do more tshuva, unless you fast. So then maybe for an individual, fasting might be more effective. And then we discussed the relationship between this and Yom Kippur, and how Yom Kippur also really probably shares the same mood, even though there is the Issacharis getting in the way of practicing the Chiyuv Suda. Nonetheless, the mood is probably similar, as the Urayim points out. And then we discussed a little bit this mitzvah of eating on Erev and Kippur, and how we see at least two major streams of thought in Rishonim, whether it's prepare for the Tainus or whether it's a reflection of Simchas Yantiv. How Ricky Vager points out in his Chuvus that somebody who's sick would be putter if it's to prepare for the Tainus, and San Ish would be putter if it's a mitzvah Sasei Shazman Grama of Simchas Yantiv, and therefore a sick woman is putter either way, and Nuan of Shach is off the hook for this. So this is a all relevant to the fact that Yom Kippur probably does share the same mood of Rosh Hashanah, except for a technical difficulty, as the Rayan points out, and whatever that mood is probably shared by both. So in any event, whether the phrase Happy New Year is relevant or not, we're not 100% sure, but whatever the proper happiness is you should have on that day of New Year, and the year itself should certainly be a happy one.